afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. You can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com, where you can subscribe to our newsletter to find out about upcoming guests, features, events, and other shows on our network. If you have any questions or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please visit us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email to questions@theorganicview.com. Today, my guest is Mr. Aaron Stevens, who's the founder of Nature's Path. Now, not too long ago, people thought of organic food as mostly consisting of tofu, bean sprouts, and granola. I can honestly tell you that tofu is not exactly what I think of as being a top choice for any ingredient that I'm going to use with meal planning, even though I have begun to use tofu more often. But, you know, times, they certainly have changed. And today, there are so many varieties of organic foods available that it's absolutely amazing how much the industry has grown. One key player in the organic industry is Nature's Path, and clearly Nature's Path has without a doubt become a household name. Founded in 1985, Nature's Path Organic Foods is headquartered in Richmond, British Columbia, and employs over 300 people at its four facilities in Canada and the United States. The privately held family-owned company produces breakfast foods and snacks sold in specialty food stores and retailers in 40 countries around the world. Now, Nature's Path truly follows my heart. They produce foods that are not only organic, but really make a concerted effort to change the perception of what organic foods are all about. Healthy foods, and this is right from their website, healthy foods don't need to be boring and tasteless, which is why we spend our days and nights dreaming up new recipes, tracking down exotic new ingredients, and researching the latest or most ancient superfoods. Talk about a vision. Today, I have the pleasure, once again, of speaking to Mr. Aaron Stevens, who is the founder of Nature's Path. He truly lives up to his company's vision, which is to be a trusted name for quality organic foods in every home, socially responsible, environmentally sustainable, and financially viable. So, at this point, I'd like to welcome Mr. Aaron Stevens. Mr. Stevens, good afternoon.
Thank you, June, and thank you, listeners. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
It is truly an honor to be able to speak to you, sir. So I just have to ask you, what was it like growing up as a kid?
I was very fortunate as a child. I was born and raised on Vancouver Island. On the 6th of January, 1944, while unloading 100-pound sacks of potatoes off the back of the pickup truck, my mom went into labor and I was born, joining my older brother, Godfrey, and our family dog, Happy. So, yeah, I was raised, born and raised in the pristine, forests and valleys of Vancouver Island. And my father, who had started out, you know, inheriting the family farm from his father, it was about 120 acres. He had, you know, been sold the promise of, chemical agriculture like all other farmers. But he quickly found other ways to farm, and he disavowed the use of chemicals in his farming practices. He said, I created an earthworm paradise by mulching his fields with a lot of stuff that was actually left over from the sawmills. He actually used sawdust, which was a free commodity in those days. He'd lay down a layer of chicken manure, and then he'd put the sawdust on top of that, and he said the earthworms did the rest, and he eventually got rid of his tractor even. He said because his mulch created the ideal cultivation with the worms going through it and creating a rich, dark humus. The mulch kept the moisture in, and only a few weeds were able to get through it. So he would plant directly into that, and he was getting 10 tons of berries per acre on land that hitherto had never been able to produce anywhere near that kind of quantity of berries.
Wow.
So our farm was called Goldstream Berry Paradise, and it was really a joy to behold in any season because of the wonderful colors of the fields, the different stages of the compost on the fields, the mulches that would turn from kind of golden into dark browns and oranges and things like that. It was really quite lovely.
Sounds like your father and my father would have become very good friends very quickly.
Yeah. I serve on the board of the Rodale Institute, which is probably the oldest organic nonprofit organization in North America. It's been involved in organic agriculture and promoting it, educating people for the last 65 years. It's been a real pleasure to be involved with that and be involved with things like Gardening for Good. We've sponsored over 70 gardens across North America, school gardens and gardens in communities which are somewhat financially distressed. And we recently just made 3 grants available. It's about $75,000, $25,000 each grant to 3 outstanding projects where communities that are in these distressed areas are actually producing food, good, wholesome organic food for people and providing good jobs. This is just some of the things. It's like the tip of the iceberg.
That is really tremendous, though. I mean, many people seem to think that businesses are bad. And the thing is that I constantly tell people it's not businesses. Businesses do wonderful things. It's the marketers. Prime example of a family-owned business that really gives back so much. And especially the way that you describe the land that you grew up, I can tell right away how much you love nature. I mean, when you have a firm appreciation for the smell of the earthworms that are coming out, and the different colors, yeah, without a doubt, you have green blood in your veins.
My mother was, she was a real lover of nature. And, my mom and dad would take me out for walks in the forest in different places, go up in the mountains or stand by the ocean because we lived on an island. And she knew all the Latin names for all of the plants in our whole bioregion.
Same thing with my parents, yeah. Wow.
And I see my parents almost as a metaphor. You know, I say, you know, if the Creator is the Father, our mother is the earth, and why stick a dagger into the heart of our mother, by polluting this world that we live in, which is kind of our mother. You know, it nurtured us. We're to nurture it as well. We're to give something back to it. And so, there's a virtuous circle by engaging in activities, farming activities, and other activities which actually enhance the life on this planet. We're only here for a certain time. We ourselves will become compost for the next generations. If we can be here to actually make this place a better world, you know, I'm a perennial optimist, and my dad used to say when we were planting corn in the fields, I was like 12 years old, he would say, always leave the soil better than you found it. And that became a metaphor in my life for always leave this world better than you found it. You know, we can focus, we can obsess about all the terrible things that are going on, but let us take a positive attitude and see what we can do to change this world and make it a better place, and leave it a better place. Because if we don't, the consequences will be absolutely, absolute disaster.
Well, you know something? If I didn't know any better, I would swear that you and I are siblings, because that's basically exactly, almost verbatim, what my parents taught me. And I'm sitting here smiling, and I realize that because we're on the radio, you can't see it, but I am just beaming. It's so amazing to be able to speak to somebody who basically had the same type of upbringing that I did. And I always felt like an oddball for so many years, just trying to explain, well, you know, my dad does things differently. And, my play dates didn't consist of hanging out with my friends. I basically had to watch the sheep graze underneath the apple trees, and, you know, books were basically my company. And, you know, just listening to you, it's great to meet somebody such as yourself that's just so wonderful. And you really have given back. I mean, just the
it's
amount
an ongoing,
of product.
It's an ongoing giving and receiving. Could I share a song that my father wrote? Because he was not just a farmer, but he was also a songwriter.
I would love that. I think everybody around the globe would love that. So please.
Great. This is called "This Earth Is Mine." This earth is mine to have and hold, this dust beneath my feet. God gave me hands to cherish it, to help the hungry eat. And if I treat it as my friend, 10 times it will repay the sweat, the toil, my good red soil. This earth is mine today. This earth is mine to have and hold. It lies beneath my feet. I know that on the summer dust, the steam of rain is sweet. And when I'm weary, old, and worn, I know that I can say, I'll pass it on to other hands, more fertile than today. It waits for me with loving arms. This earth is mine that day.
That is, wow. That is something that I'm actually going to go back after the show is over, and I'm going to write down all the words, because that is just something that more people need to hear. That's just absolutely beautiful. And your father wrote that?
Yes. He wrote over 1,000 songs, even though he couldn't write a word of a note of music. He kept it all in his head, and then he'd hum the tunes to somebody who could play the piano or play the guitar, and then they'd write down the notes for it.
Wow.
He even wrote instrumentals in that way.
Did you ever publish the songs?
Oh, yes. He had many records published, and some near hits, but not quite. He had one called, let's see, "The Chipmunk Is Lucky, He Doesn't Know It, Chews on a Nut But Didn't Grow It."
Wow. Your father was some character.
Yeah, he was. I mean, and Disney wanted to do it, but Disney wanted to use it in a movie called Perry. But they told him he'd have to take out the references to the Lord. My father wasn't a religious man, but he was a spiritual man. And he used the term, the Lord is, the Lord looks after his own. And they said, you have to take that word, the Lord, out, okay? But he refused to. And he said, no, this song was an inspiration. I'm not going to change the words to it. And thus the Big Time passed him by. Anyway, you know, he was a man of uncompromising principles.
Well, if I could share something with you that I saw recently on a sign that was posted, that was a sign from a local church. It read, and I hope I get this right, God wants fruitful nuts, not nutty fruits. And unfortunately, Disney missed out on that boat. They should have really not been so paranoid and just looked for it, looked at his words as what they were, which is pure inspiration. I mean, I think there's this misconception that people have about many different things, but pertaining to just your own belief system and so on and so forth, and people just, they're so afraid to embrace anything good, but yet they'll quickly embrace something that's not good, which is kind of interesting. And the same thing with organic. I mean, people, for many, many years, I would lecture and people would say, oh, yeah, you know, how are you organic? You know, I thought you had to wear a tie-dye and Birkenstocks. And I would explain, would very clearly explain to them that organic, you don't need to wear tie-dye to wear organic clothing. And you don't need to eat bean sprouts in order to eat organically grown produce. And,
yeah.
You know, that's clearly part of your company's mission, and it's just amazing. I mean, look at where we are today, especially with all the negativity that's out there that, oh, organic, it's just a myth. Oh, you know, don't buy organic, just buy local, that's good enough. And lo and behold, your company continues to prevail. And
well, yeah, we're very fortunate in that we've been able to survive, many of the tests that my peers had not passed, I would say, who either went out of business or sold out, you know, to large multinational corporations. I get approached probably at least two times a week by multinational companies that want to buy, you know, into Nature's Path. They want to buy us out. And we're not for sale at any price. We plan to leave this as a legacy for the coming generations. And we absolutely refuse. All those inquiries that come in, they go into the round file. I kind of detest what's happened in some ways, and yet it was inevitable. The taking over of the organic industry by a lot of multinationals. But we've always tried to remain true to our roots and to our vision. And it wasn't to just sell out, and make millions of dollars of profit just by selling out. But we have our children involved. We have our next generation of managers involved. And they're going to take the reins from us. You know, I'm going to be 67 soon, and I've had a great run. I'd feel very fulfilled if I were able to engraft the same kind of principles and vision in the next generation that's going to lead our company. By the way, we have over 400 employees now. We opened a large facility in Wisconsin. A couple of years ago, and then the recession hit, and we didn't do anything with it for a while. We put it in mothballs, and now we've got organic toaster pastries and organic toaster waffles that we're producing in the plant. Soon we'll be producing breakfast cereals there. And we have two other plants as well, one in Washington State and another one in Canada. So this little dream, you know, that started as the little red engine that could has been, you know, chugging up hills, and we've passed through the fires, and we've somehow managed to survive. And I really thank God for my life companion, Radna. We met in India. We had a remarkable meeting. We were introduced, and some people would say it was like an arranged marriage. And that happened over 41 and a half years ago. And she's been with me ever since. We've got four wonderful children, two of whom are involved in the company. Another one has got her own organic bakery company. We're trying to encourage farmers to grow more organic and get away from chemicals, because the chemicals are just polluting our land and our water, our air, our bodies. So organic is really, really an important part of the paradigm shift that is necessary to transform our world and to make it into a better place. We can't just keep on dumping millions and millions of tons of pesticides and herbicides and chemical fertilizers on the land and into our water systems without disastrous effects. Organic farming also acts as a carbon sink. It actually collects carbon, and it is much more efficient at doing that than any other type of farming. It provides a decent living for the farmers. There are hundreds of farmers that are dependent on Nature's Path. They grow their crops, and we buy them. We transform them into tasty foods. And we have this wonderful relationship with our suppliers. I'd say our relationship with our suppliers, our farmers, the farm families that we deal with, is as important as the relationship that we have with our customers. And a lot of people don't realize that. There's a front end and there's a back end.
So in essence, you really have continued the farmers, the old school farmers' way of doing business, where you knew exactly who you were buying from, you knew the people that were involved.
And some of those relationships go back more than 30 years.
Wow.
And we're now seeing the younger generation coming onto the farmers. One of the great challenges in North America is the graying of the farmers. A lot of farmers are just getting old and they're dying, and they don't have any of the next generation to take over their farms. And so what you have are these huge factory farms. You have vast acreages which are run as almost like machines. And to do that, they have to use huge machinery and lots of chemicals. And the chemicals, of course, the cost of the chemicals keep going up. The chemicals pollute the land, they pollute the water, they create the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, I mean, I could just go, I could rant on and on and on. Whereas supporting the small, smaller organic farms, family farms, these people are getting are making a decent livelihood out of it. The farmers are our heroes. They're our unsung heroes. We don't see them, but without them, we don't have good food. And all of us should say, well, thank you to the farmers. You know, the old American Indians, they used to say, you know, we would say, thank you, Lord, for the food, and they would say, let us give thanks to the food.
You know, if you think about it, that's really something, because it's basically something that's coming from the earth, and it's a process. There's a lot of love involved, there's a lot of nurturing involved, and it's something that a lot of care has to go into.
Well, you're an organic gardener. You're a master gardener, and you know how much work is involved in growing good food. It is hard work, but you know, people go and spend money. They go and spend money to go to gyms to work out, but the farmer, you know, and the gardener, they have the best of both worlds in some ways, because they're doing sometimes backbreaking labor. They're doing very hard work out there in the field or in the plot in the garden, and they're getting their exercise. They're using their whole body. It's not necessarily aerobic workout, but it is. They say that the gardeners are often the longest lived people, because they've developed certain rhythms with themselves and with the land. I find that sometimes after I've been at work all day, sitting behind a desk, dealing with, you know, situations in the company, and I'm totally tired. I go home, I walk through my garden. I have a very large organic garden. I walk through the garden, I breathe the air, and I just automatically start pulling weeds, and I'll get a fork, and I'll turn some compost over, and my energy comes back.
I think it's because you're resonating with it's resonating with nature, and also as all gardeners know, gardening is very therapeutic. It's very peaceful because you're doing something that makes you feel good, because you're doing something that is not only positive, but you're working directly with nature. And there is so much to be learned about just the effects of working with nature, just the energy balance that you get from working from gardening, whether it's a small container garden or if you have a large parcel of land where you have different types of beds, whether they're ornamentals or vegetables, herbs, fruit, what have you. And just out of curiosity, so tell me, what do you grow?
Okay. I have three gardens that I manage. And one is my home garden, which is about 2,500 square foot vegetable garden with berries. And we've got a couple of acres of land. I get all of the residues from the trees, that the leaves, you know, the grasses, the weeds, and everything, and all the kitchen waste is all composted, and that goes right into the soil. And the more that soil, when I came there, it was just sandy, rocky stuff that wasn't, you know, fit to grow anything except weeds. Now we've got this rich, loamy soil that's dark, and it's like chocolate cake. And the worms are, you know, are very abundant in it. So in that we grow all kinds of every kind of vegetable you can imagine. We grow squashes, we grow beans, peas, all the leafy vegetables, root vegetables. We grow blueberries, strawberries, raspberries. We have golden raspberries, black raspberries, purple raspberries. So we grow all the you know, the broccoli type stuff, the kale, potatoes, tomatoes.
How many types of tomatoes do you grow?
I've got five or six different varieties going right now. I've got some that look like almost chocolate brown, and some that are gold and yellow, some red ones that have kind of brown streaks in them and things like that. They're very very unique and very, very tasty. Whereas the stuff you buy in the store, it has absolutely no flavor.
It tastes like cardboard.
The greenhouse tomatoes and produce that's grown in greenhouses, it just doesn't have any flavor. Hydroponic
stuff. And it
doesn't
have the smell. You know that smell that your tomatoes have?
I know. And if it doesn't smell good and if it doesn't taste good, it's probably not that good for you.
I was going to say, I know with my tomatoes, just when you touch one of the branches of a tomato, just the smell that is, it kind of rubs off on your skin, and it just smells wonderful.
It is a wonderful, wonderful fragrance, and that's my home garden, and then we have a garden at Nature's Path behind our head office. We have about 60, 70 people that work at our head office in marketing and operations and finance and what have you. And behind there, I created a garden for the staff, and we put in raised beds for each department. Unfortunately, not that many people go out there, and I thought everybody would just love to get out there, but not that many people are actually into getting dirt under their fingernails, or they're afraid to do something. And so they get out there at least twice a year, but I find that myself, I'm not only the CEO of the company, but it seems like I spend a fair amount of time in the staff garden just making sure that everything is looking good and being done, properly. So, sometimes people will pour in a bunch of seeds in the ground and then you've got everything that's growing up too close together. So what I like to do is I'll thin that out, and of course I'll plant the things that I thin out and plant them in another patch somewhere else. You know what it's like.
Yeah.
And I'm also involved with another garden out in Richmond, which is a volunteer project. It's a meditation center with a large organic garden, and I'm the chair of the Richmond Food Security Society, which is involved in all the community gardens in our area. And also the food bank. So a lot of the food that's grown, it all goes to the food bank. And I think something like there are 30,000 people every week that are dependent on the food bank in our area. Most of them are families.
One of the things that I've discovered from my experiences at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden is in regards to specifically the community gardens. When a community actually is active with their community garden, you have people that are communicating. You have businesses, like, for example, one of the very successful programs that the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, the folks there have been doing with Brooklyn Greenbridge is with the work with the community gardens, just educating people about the importance of composting. And basically you have people that live in the concrete jungle, mind you, that are taking their kitchen scraps, bringing it down to the community garden. You have businesses that, instead of spending money to have that waste hauled away, they are bringing it down to the community garden. And lo and behold, you have people that are communicating. You have people that will bump into each other and get to know the local businesses, get to know the residents, and they'll take their families to the community garden. They will spend time there just because they want to be able to relax and just, let go. And that's one of the beautiful things about gardening. And it was just interesting, with all this communication going on, that there was less crime. Because people were happier. Yeah, so that's something that I think our elected officials should really pay attention to. And I think, for the most part, throughout history, many, especially recent history, many of our elected officials don't really understand the value of the community garden and its place in society. I really think that the work that you're doing, it really does send a very clear message that, yeah, not only is it feeding people, but it's really helping to improve the way that we communicate with one another and the way that we just coexist.
I think children will grow up healthier and more balanced if they have gardens in the schools where they can grow some of their own vegetables and see how they grow, because a lot of people think that vegetables originated in the supermarket, you know, all wrapped in plastic.
Yeah, that's scary.
And also I think it would be a great thing if all the prisons also had community gardens within the prisons. And I bet you there'd be much less violence as well in the prisons if people were put in touch with nature. I think a lot of the crimes that originate, they take place because people are so far removed from nature. And they don't know the joy of being, you know, near green living things. And if they're around them and if they help nurture them, then I think some of their negative tendencies would be channeled in the right direction.
I agree with you. And actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because of the fact that I remember hearing something or other about something that New York City was doing something with some of the community gardens. I don't know which particular one, but I knew that it was someplace in Brooklyn. It might have been Red Hook. I don't recall the exact community garden, but I remember seeing an interview in which they were talking to the inmates and how it really helped to improve their entire outlook and helped to really rehabilitate these people. And that's something that, once again, doesn't cost a lot of money, especially as far as taxpayers' dollars are concerned, and it's something that's good for the environment, it's good for society. So it makes you just wonder, why aren't we doing it?
With Nature's Path, my company, has partnered with the Rodale Institute in a project called Gardens for Good, and I would invite your listeners to go onto our website and check out Gardens for Good. These are community gardens and some of the beneficial effects that they have on people. There is a garden here in Vancouver that we support. It got a grant from us. And it's down in the area which is known as Skid Row. That's where a lot of really disadvantaged people live. They're on the fringes of society. A lot of drug addicts and alcoholics and prostitution and what have you. And right in this area, somebody has given up a large, you know, like about a half a block of land for gardens. And we support this project. They have raised bed gardens, actually right on top of the asphalt. Everything is composted and it's put in these boxes and it's all organic. And they produce a tremendous amount of food there. And they're employing some of the people in the neighborhood. And they're selling the produce to restaurants, you know, to get some recovery of some of the costs. And the rest of it's donated to the food banks. I think, you know, Gardens for Good, you could also call it Gardens for Hope, because it does give people some hope out of the despair of you know, those who are most marginalized in our society. So, you know, we got to take care of the least of us, so that they become the most of us.
And for those of you that are listening, if you go to www.naturespath.com, and that's NaturesPath.com, you will see the link right there on the homepage for it. So please, it's right on the homepage. It says Get on the Path, and it says Gardens for Good. So you can find out more about that wonderful, wonderful project. I mean, it's just amazing that you're doing all of these things. How do you have the time?
You know, you have to make time. And a wise man once told me, he said, if you ever want to get anything done, always go to a busy person.
You know something? There's a lot of wisdom in that comment, because usually that's That's one of the reasons I think why everybody comes to me.
Yeah.
How do you
get
this done? Well, you know, you manage. Well, I don't really think about it. I kind of, you know, just do it and afterwards think about it. But it's just nice to talk to somebody else who understands that. So, wow. So,
We're doing it. There's some other things that we're doing. You know, like I haven't really talked about our business, and because you know the business is there, and our products are there all over North America. But I'd rather really talk about the things that really they're not money makers, but they're really important things. One of the projects that we're involved in, and it's coming up on October the 2nd, is called "Put Your Compassion into Action." And I think it was a couple of years ago, the Dalai Lama and other Nobel Peace Prize winners were here in Vancouver. And you heard this word, you know, you have to be compassionate and compassionate to all living beings and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So after a while, I got kind of sick of hearing the word compassion. And I said, well, what are people doing? Well, how are they putting it into action? And so the idea was born to put your compassion into action. So that's our latest project. It's called Compassion into Action. And it's raising. Our goal right now is to raise $1 million for the food banks in our area. And based on the success of it this year, we plan to roll it out to other cities in the United States, putting compassion into action. It does take a lot of energy, but I think again, it's very worthwhile. A lot of the people that are actually dependent on food banks are not. They're not homeless people. They're people who just can't make enough money, you know, or have been put out of work, and they have families to support. And I think, you know, everybody should try to support their local food bank. And this is what we're trying to raise awareness of and raise money for in this Compassion into Action project that we're involved in. But, you know, also we're involved with something called We Day. I don't know if you've heard of that. It started by Mark Thielberger. He was a boy that went to India, and he went and visited the sweatshops, you know, where footballs and clothes and shoes and all that are made, and saw children, you know, 9, 8, 9, 10 years old in virtual slavery 7 days a week, working 12, 16 hours a day. And he brought this to the world's attention. And anyway, it evolved into something called We Day, and these there's a couple of events that we're sponsoring this year, which are engaging young people. And I was here last year, I think it was a year and a half ago, 16,000 screaming kids had filled this huge auditorium saying that we are going to change the world. We're not going to make the same mistakes that our generation, you know, the generation that we sprang from, made in the 20th century. We're going to work to end poverty. We're going to work to end child slavery. We're going to do this. And there's a lot of energy from the young people, and if it's directed in the right way, it will change this world. And I do believe in the coming generation. I believe that a lot of them are a lot wiser than we were when we were their age.
Well, I think they've also had the benefit of learning from our mistakes, and they don't want to make the same mistakes. You know, it's interesting. I remember just growing up on a farm, and then all of a sudden, all we heard in the news was about the starving children in Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, you know, there was a cry for help, and then the technology came. But the thing is that we were just so willing and eager to help these people that we weren't really thinking about what we were doing. We're just doing something for the sake of doing something. And I think that's where many people realize that, hey, we need to think about this. We need to think about what we're doing. Because once again, when you react instead of act, you're basically just responding instead of taking an action that is going to provide a result instead of just a quick fix. And I think everything that you've been doing is really tremendous as far as being influential for the next generation when they're dealing with some of the aftermath from what our generation has done. And, you know, it's just amazing just to be able to witness this. I mean, if you think about this in years to come, how this is going to be in our history, it's going to be in textbooks about all the different things that companies such as yourself have been doing. And it's just surreal almost.
You know, business is not bad. I think it's really, it's people that are either good or bad. And if people allow their companies to rampage and destroy the environment, you know, destroy the nest that we're all in, they will suffer the consequences, and others will suffer the consequences. But we are given a responsibility to be good stewards of our resources, good stewards of our businesses, and we should make sure that our businesses are also for good, that that serve the common good, and not just line our own pockets. There's nothing wrong with making a profit, and you know,
you have to feed your family.
Yeah, you have to feed your family. You have to pay, you know, your debts. You know, there's an old saying, as the good book says, if you're not a prophet, you're a loss. And so
that's a really good one.
it's very, very important, you know, that a business does run profitably. Otherwise, it won't stay in business for long.
No, and especially if you think about farmers, for example, a farmer has to be able to produce something that can be sold in order to be able to just keep the operations going. And whether it's a small farm where you know you're growing a couple of crops, or you have a very large farm where you're selling dairy products or whatever the case may be.
Or growing grain. Yeah.
Exactly. And the thing is that people just have this misconception that if you have a business, oh, you know, you're supposed to, you're not supposed to grow, you're not supposed to do this, you're not supposed to do that. And I can't say it enough. It's businesses need to grow because businesses do give back and they, you know, they do contribute to society. It's just the marketers.
A couple of years ago, we were approached by two farm families in the prairies who said, look, they are committed organic farmers. And they said, look, we have enough equipment here to actually cultivate another 1,000 acres or more. And our children are working in the oil fields. And we can't attract them to come and work on the farm because there isn't enough revenue. So they came to us with a proposal. They said, we don't have the money to buy the land. Why don't you buy the land and we'll farm it for you? And so we formed this cooperative relationship where we bought two farms with a total of 2,250 acres, something like that, grain farms in Saskatchewan. And these two farm families actually cultivate the land, and they were able to bring their two sons, big strapping guys, back from the oil fields to farm. And they are now, you know, earning enough to actually provide for, you know, provide an income for their sons. So we're seeing in this way these graying farmers, you know, have been able to attract their kids back to the land. And so what we do is they farm the land and they take two-thirds of the crop and we take one-third of the crop, and then we buy the whole crop from them. And it's worked out very, very well. It's a very nice symbiotic relationship. And we actually have a profile of Garth Glass, one of the farm families, on our website. And it shows him walking through the fields, showing the farmland, and which has been transitioned into organic, which is still in transition. I'm happy to say now that all of that acreage has been transitioned into organic agriculture because it takes 3 years.
So just out of curiosity, do you have bees?
Bees? You know, we just started keeping bees about just this summer, and I love bees. I used to work for an apiary when I was like 21 or 22. One of the first jobs I had was extracting honey at a bee apiary. So we've got three hives now, at the SOS Meditation and Ecology Center in Richmond, and they've been able to pollinate the crops, and they're producing lots of honey. They're really happy there. There's lots of flowers, and there's lots of plants, you know, that they're fertilizing or pollinating. And next year we're gonna plant between all the blueberries and raspberries. We're gonna sow red clover because that's a great cover crop. It adds nitrogen to the soil, and it's kind of a mow and blow thing. You know, you run your mower over it and blow it into the crop. But the bees love clover, and they just love clover. So we're changing the way that we're planting now, just so that we can also feed the bees.
I think that is fabulous. I mean, the bees. Anybody who gardens, you've got to have bees. One other question: do you have a butterfly habitat?
We do. We have, you know, a buddleia.
You knew it.
Yeah, yeah. We have buddleia, and we have other plants that attract bees and hummingbirds.
Hummingbirds. Wow, you were.
I'm saying butterflies and buddleia.
No,
bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds. I love hummingbirds.
They're amazing. They have. I think it's a little bit further out east on Long Island, where they have a habitat that attracts hummingbirds, and many people visit there specifically to see the hummingbirds. And now you are definitely, without a doubt, a true gardener. Anybody that is so passionate not only about the different colors of the soil, I can imagine what it must be like just to watch you when you see all of the seedlings begin to grow, and just watch the different varieties of the different vegetables and how they differ. And I can almost imagine the smile on your face as everything is just coming to life. And it's just such a wonderful feeling. And
but as you know, June, it all begins with good soil.
Oh, and, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And, you know, the work of doing a little weeding and harvesting is minuscule compared to what's involved in the soil preparation. As you know.
And I tell you, when it's interesting just listening to you talk about how you'll actually go out in your garden after a very long day, and most people what I'm finding is most people that I speak to that do have gardens, they do the same thing, because you kind of feel like it's your little sanctuary where you completely just let go and there are no more worries in the world.
I love the fact of, you know, you create something of beauty. Can I share another song?
I would love it.
I'm going to attempt to sing this. Across the plain, my yellow grain lies restless as the sea. How could this all be given to a guy like me? To fill my need, I sowed the seed, and now repaid I'll be. How could this all be given to a guy like me? The seasons change with splendor. My ceiling is the sky. The earth, my master, cruel and tender. Happy man am I. The sun, the rain, the wind, the snow, the rapture to be free. How could this all be given to a guy like me? Two arms that gladly share my toil or hold me tenderly. And this has all been given to a guy like me. That's my father, Rupert.
That was beautiful, and I didn't mean to clap before. I thought the song was ended. I apologize, but that was absolutely beautiful. So now I'm going to, and everybody out there, you better be clapping, because that was really beautiful. And Mr. Disney, you really missed out completely. And hey, you know something? It doesn't mean that at some point there won't be a movie, along with the already made soundtrack for the movie, especially since everything was written by your father. And, you know, your father really was such a talented man, and that must have been really great.
You know, in the song that Disney rejected, you know, he says, the winter creeps down and down the mountains, turns the waterfalls to crystal fountains. The Lord looks after his own. Gone is the glory of the sun. Gone is the summer rain. Though only blue notes fill the air, lovely spring will come again. Though life will bring you tears and sorrow, all men will share that great tomorrow.
And Disney turned that down.
Yeah.
I guess they never heard of somebody called Johnny Cash, because I do believe Johnny Cash started out singing all sorts of music like that. Well, not like that, but, you know, that were based...
Oh, thank you. Johnny Cash was, you know, very talented, extremely talented.
Oh, I love Johnny Cash. In fact, when the movie came out, I went opening day, and I'm not really a big fan of waiting on lines or anything like that for movies. I usually like to wait for the crowds to die down. But yeah, your dad, wow.
I saw that movie too. It was good. You know, I was born and raised on the farm, but when I was 13 years old, my parents decided to sell the farm, and that was the saddest day of my life. And we went down Humpback Road. It was called, because we lived under a mountain called Humpback Mountain. And so we went down Humpback Road, and my cat, Dizzy, was left behind. Dizzy was, he got that name because when he was a kitten, I kind of trained him to turn around in circles. If I just stood before him and circled my finger in front of his face, he would start turning around like a dervish. And so when I was crying and our car was, you know, slowly driving down Humpback Lane for the last time, Dizzy was running beside the car, yowling. And I was crying, and he was crying, and so I thought that we would never meet again. And, you know, a year later, we were down in Hollywood, California, where my father was pursuing the music industry, and we were up on Coenga Boulevard in our little rented hacienda, and I was watering the garden, and one day this same orange tabby cat comes up the steps, but kind of worse for wear, and comes right up to me, and I just said, "Dizzy, is that you?" And I circled my finger in front of Dizzy's face, and the cat started turning around. And the next thing you know, it was rubbing against my leg. But do you have any rational explanation for this? How did a cat get from Vancouver Island onto the mainland, travel 1,500 miles to Los Angeles, and find his boy in the middle of a city of 10 million people?
Actually, there's a lady who is a wildlife expert named Laura Lasseter, and I'll introduce you to her. She's really an expert on wildlife, period, but she could tell you a couple of interesting things when it comes to animals and some of the most miraculous tales that have, you know, true stories about how animals have been separated by... people have been separated, rather, by their animal companions, if you will. And it's just amazing how they find their way home. And you basically were home to Dizzy. And as a cat lover, I'm a dog lover too, but as a cat lover, that really just touches my heart, because I would definitely be heartbroken if my cat and I were separated. And I would hope that she would somehow try to track me down and find me in the same way, but that's a story that you just can't make up. What did your family say?
Everybody was amazed. It was absolute. Yeah, everybody was amazed. But after a few months, the cat disappeared. It probably got ran over, unfortunately. But you know, that was life in Hollywood. And
wow.
Yeah, amazing. You know, in our house, we used to have jam sessions. My father would have jam sessions there, and Lou Rawls would come over and he recorded one of my dad's songs, and Ricky Nelson and Sonny Bono, who was, you know, later paired up with Cher.
Uh-huh.
That was before he met Cher. They used to come over and they used to jam and they would write songs until the wee hours of the morning.
So how did you wind up getting back to the farm?
Well, my father's ambition was to make it big in the song business and go back and buy the farm. But you know, as Omar Khayyam has said, you know, the moving pen having writ moves on, and all your tears and all your piety and all your wit cannot erase a jot of it. You can't go back, in a way. You're forced to go forward. And but I always had the farm turned into a trailer park eventually. But my father's seeds were there in me, and I wanted to find a vocation in life that somehow fulfilled need to create some kind of utopia. I was an idealist. Admittedly, I was an idealist. But my idealism took me to India, and I studied with spiritual teachers. And I spent 7 months there, came back, and started a little vegetarian restaurant in Vancouver in 1967. And that became the foundation of our little empire. I started it with $7 borrowed. I had $7 to my name, and I borrowed $1,500. And with that $1,500 loan, started the restaurant. And within a year, I paid back the loan. And we just never looked back. We just kept on growing and growing and growing. I got into a partnership with a couple of friends, and we started the company called Lifestream. And after 10 years, that grew, and we had 100 employees, and it was quite a thriving business. But the partnership problems developed, and we ended up selling it. So back in 1985, all over again, starting from scratch, my wife and I started Nature's Path, and we never looked back on that. And every year, you know, sales would double, and then over the past many years, we've grown every year 20 to 30% every year until the recession hit. The recession has been has provided some very interesting lessons for us, but it's just shown us how to do better with less, and it's put us in touch with the reality of, you know, the economics of people being, you know, what is it, 10 million people thrown out of work or something, has been a very, very devastating, you know, to communities across North America. And we're starting now to see a slight recovery, you know.
You know, with the economy, one of the positive things that I've noticed, and actually I was at something with my church, and we were talking about this, and one of the positive things about the economy being in the tank is the fact that people are starting to cook at home. They're starting to read their labels again. They're starting to grow their own vegetables again. They're starting to communicate again.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's putting people back in touch with nature all over again. And in order to make, I think, significant changes in our lives, we need significant and drastic things to happen. And sometimes these devastating events may be the only way that this transition can take place. I know for me personally, this is before I launched the Organic View radio show, I was in a different place. I mean, I was still educating the public about the importance of organics and as far as composting and horticulture, you know, so on and so forth. The list goes on and on. But the thing is that at this particular point, there is such a great need for more education, more information, and information that's not censored, information that's not manipulated, but simply is coming directly from the source. And that's why talking to people who are so incredibly accomplished and have seen so much and contributed so much to society, it's so important for our audience who's, you know, I have listeners that are located in Australia, in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, all over Canada, the United States, South America, you know, and to be able to hear directly from you everything that you've done, well, not everything, but, you know, give the audience some idea of the wonderful things that you've done is truly inspirational.
Well, the show ain't over yet. let me just end with a quote from one of my great teachers. We were meeting with an organic farmer back in 1972, and Frank Ford, and he said, my teacher said, to grow a blade of grass is more than a patriot's work.
Wow. I'm just thinking about that. That's just so... you could write a whole book.
Yeah.
when are you going to write a book?
Well, I've got a book out, which is sold out, actually, and probably going to republish it again, called Moth and the Flame.
Excellent.
And another book is coming out, is being published by Rodale Press. It's coming out in the spring, and it's called The Compassionate Diet. And
go ahead.
Yeah, it's coming out, and look for it in the spring of 2011.
So, what is? Can you just give us a little scoop as far as what we can expect in the book?
More
of your dad's songs, I hope.
Well, it explores diet and compassion and compassionate eating and how it has been a part of great spiritual traditions for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And I also go into the medical and ecological benefits of a compassionate diet. And the subtitle is How What You Eat Can Change Your Life and Save the Planet.
Wow. It's so true, though. I mean, what we do eat, it not only affects our health, but if people just think for a moment here about what's being said right now, if you think about your food, the way that it's grown, so on and so forth, you know, back to the origin, and you think about the pesticides that are or are not present, you know, that really does make a significant impact. Mm-hmm. And that's really something to think about. And for those of you that are tuning in, you know, ask your family, talk about it with your families. That's a really excellent topic to discuss with your children even, and to just get a conversation going and just talking, just to talk about the importance of what, not only what you're eating, but where it's coming from, so on and so forth. And I have a question for you. In regards to your work with the farmers, are primarily the ingredients are coming from the United States and Canada?
Yes. We do source some organic sugar from a very large cooperative in Brazil. And those are our main supplies of like a lot of the fruits we get from California, dried fruits and nuts and things like that. Most of the grains come from the Midwest, and blueberries come from the Atlantic region. It's a fairly diverse thing. And one of the reasons why we opened the plant in the Midwest was so that we could be closer to our grain supply, and so we don't have to, like, source grain from the middle of the country, ship it to the West Coast, process it into cereal and other breakfast foods, and then ship it back to the East Coast. We wanted to, you know, lessen our carbon footprint, so we felt that we had a great opportunity with this very large plant that we acquired from Kraft Foods in Sussex, Wisconsin. And we're currently employing about 90 people there, and probably within a year it'll probably be way over 200 people there.
That's tremendous.
We don't consider them employees, but we consider them valued team members because we're all part of this team together working, we can achieve much more than our singular efforts.
I think that's just absolutely amazing. I mean, more people need to understand, especially Americans, that there's so much being done here by American organic companies to help support the farmers, and that this is basically an example for other companies to follow. So instead
I'm a byproduct of both Canada, United States, and England. My father was born in England, came over here. My mother was born in Kent, Washington, and they produced me on Vancouver Island. And I've lived in the United States for several years, and so kind of like I feel kind of like a global citizen. I've lived in India. I've traveled all over the world, spent time in different places. And I think we're all one, really. And if you look at the DNA projects, we all share 99.9% common DNA, and the little fraction of a percent that is different accounts for our skin color, our shape, our size. But essentially, we're all one and the same. And I think we come from the same source, and ultimately go back to the same source.
That is, that's really just, I couldn't have said it better. That, once again, it's the realization of just where we are and just how we all interact. And that's something really important to think about because, once again, it goes back to where your food is coming from, how it's grown, and what we're doing to get the food. And the fact that you have been so instrumental in taking care of the earth as you work with it in order to produce such high quality food. It's, once again, a wonderful example of what companies should be doing. And,
well, we try. We're not perfect. My daughter Jyoti is our human resources director, and she's also a director of sustainability and social responsibility to make sure that we're all keeping on the same track and trying to align everybody toward a common goal. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity to address your many listeners across the planet, and I bow to all of you and thank you for your patient listening and allowing me to share some crumbs that I've gleaned along the way.
Well, it is more than just some crumbs, and I want to thank you for taking so much time, especially, what time is it there now?
It's 10, I don't know, what time is it? It's 10, 7 minutes after 10 a.m.
Oh, well, thank you so much for taking so much time out of your really incredibly busy schedule and for sharing a piece of your heart with our audience, especially something so special as those precious memories from your dad.
And thank you for your vision.
Oh, thank you. And before I let you go, I just want to make a special announcement. Nature's Path has a giveaway, and the giveaway is for 5 baskets that include an assortment of absolutely delectable, organic Nature's Path foods, and this is an offer that is available to U.S. and Canadian residents only, and that's basically because of with the previous giveaways, we've had issues with customs and whatnot. So, unfortunately, folks, this is just for the U.S. and Canada, and the offer is actually open for the next 2 weeks, and then the contest will be closed. All entrants must email contest@naturespath.com to be entered, and that's contest@naturespath.com in order to be entered. And if you go to theorganicview.com, there's actually a link up at the top that says contests, and you can find the information there. So good luck, everyone. And Mr. Stevens, thank you so much once again for being on the show. It has just been a pleasure, and we definitely have to have you back on again because there's just so much that needs to be told, especially directly from you, and so many wonderful stories that we need to hear.
Thank you so much, and I hope you can go on our Facebook page as well. We have three eco tours as well as prizes, and two great places. And this would be probably pretty exciting for your listeners if they won this. And there's no cost to enter.
Yes. Yes, thank you so much for mentioning that. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in, and have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.